QC Pod is a production of the Queen's Podcast Lab. For more, visit queenspodcastlab.org. This is the QC Pod, a podcast about the people, projects, and ideas that make the Queen's College community. I'm Eden Ayala of the Queen's Podcast Lab. This week, we have an interview from the Knight News Editor-in-Chief, Sid Malvia. He sat down with Professor Zara Zakari of Biology and Charisse Evans of Chemistry about undergraduate research. Coming up next.
Good morning, everybody. I am joined today by Dr. Zara Zakari from the Biology Department and Dr. Charisse Evans from the Chemistry Department. Thank you both for joining with me today. So we're going to be talking about research and obviously all the things that come with it. Dr. Zakari, why don't you start us off by talking about why research? You know, how did you get into it and why is it something you do even today?
Why research? Because I was a curious person. I wanted to know the answer to everything. I got into research really because I always wanted to know how things work. That was as a child. But later on, I was encouraged by my faculty in my undergraduate that told me actually there's a possibility for me to do research. And it was much more difficult at that time, but he gave me a chance to go in the lab. And once I went in the lab and started doing things. And I always loved the lab part of the biology. I was actually a math major and then I took a bio course and I wanted to go to mathematics and nuclear physics. But when I took a biology course and I learned about genetics and how things work inside the cells, I just got so fascinated by that. So I switched my majors and it gave me a chance to work in the lab and I just fell in love with it. And slowly one step at a time, I went on and I did my master's and then a PhD, and I started doing research. And I didn't really thought about the teaching part of it as much, but then it came with it in a way, you know, because I always realized I was teaching everybody how to do this. So I started even as an undergraduate to run the labs, and then they liked my work there. So I started teaching, and I taught biochemistry and genetics. And then later on, I became a researcher. I went to Columbia and they felt even more in love with research because the opportunities were there. And then I decided I always had this love affair with Queen's College when I was an undergraduate. And I liked the ideology of Queen's College. And I liked the fact that the Queen's College was for a class of people who were not so privileged to be in their Ivy League schools and not have maybe all the things they wanted. But yet they had incredibly bright students. And always worked really well. So when they invited me to come for a job interview, even though I had I was working in medical school, Rutgers Medical School, I came for a talk and they offered me the job pretty much at the end of the day. And I was very excited about it. I always dreamed about coming back and working with this group of people. And I have never looked back. And I remember being told when I was leaving these Ivy League schools that I may never be getting a grant. I may never be able to do research. Well, they were totally wrong because they said Queen's College at the time was not so established for research. That didn't work for me. For me, it was just the opposite. I had the pleasure of knowing a lot of brilliant students in my career. I've been there for 30 years now. And I have never been without a grant. And my lab has been always very active. And I am not to give a lot of things for myself, but it allowed me to become a leader in my field and to be able to take what I learned to many countries, to many places. And also the faculty that helped me to start this was an underrepresented minority. And he told me how difficult it was for people of color to become scientists and how few of them there were. And I was always curious. And then I realized women at that time were also, and still are not the top of the line in a sense. We're getting there. You know, we don't seem to have hold the offices that much. much yet, but it's getting there. So I started working with NIH from when I started Queen's College just about 30 years ago. And I was invited to be a reviewer in their grants, and I had a special grants from them. So when I got there, then somebody started asking me about reviewing educational grants and research grants for specific kind of needs. And that's how I became a MARC program director and worked with, at that time, they were called MORE Group of NIH, which is for specifically to encourage underrepresented minority to do research and to be researchers. And I've always had this keen love for undergraduate students to be in the lab because I got that chance and that's how I became a researcher. So my lab has always been full of, I have probably trained over 100 undergraduate students in my lab over the years. And some of them are not very good and they're not very serious. It's not like all of them are terrific. And I think Cherise knows that. And some of them are just there because they think it's good for them to go to medical school, which is also really good. I don't mind that. But a lot of them I found to be great. And they are my children. And I'm very privileged that most of them have gone up to do great things. So that's a little story of that.
A really, you know, transformative story all the way from undergraduate up until now. So, you know, Dr. Evans, let's talk to you. What's it like being a mentor? You know, at first, you know, you were obviously an undergraduate. And as I recall from our conversations, you worked in a physical chemistry lab, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
What was that like?
The funny thing is I have a very similar story to Thara. I started research as an undergraduate as well, and I don't think I would have gone on to a PhD program if I hadn't done that because I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself. So I just didn't think I was good enough to get a PhD. And I see that a lot in our students as well. Many of the students at Queen's College are first generation students from immigrant families, and they also don't really feel in their heart that they're good enough to go on to graduate school. So the encouragement they get by doing undergraduate research and being supported by a mentor is rather important for them in terms of going on to graduate school. And they go on to really good graduate schools. We've been incredibly lucky, and we have a reputation now, at least according to colleagues of mine at National Labs, of producing remarkable undergraduate students that succeed highly when they go into graduate programs. And they weren't just talking about my group, they were talking about Queen's College in general, because I was at the time lamenting the lack of PhD students, and I got told, you know, maybe I ought to focus on what we do very well, which is train undergraduate students who go on to be highly successful, and that Queen's College had a really good reputation for that. But being a mentor for undergraduates is much harder. It takes a lot more time. It's more beneficial when the students are interested in research because everybody gets more out of it. But research at a university is never the most efficient process because the moment you get a student trained where they really know what they're doing and they can argue with you, they leave. And that's true for undergraduates and graduate students. It doesn't matter. Right as a graduate student gets ready and really knows what they're doing and understands their problem and is really, really outputting, they graduate and they go off to the job. So it's never a really efficient process to do research at a university because you're constantly losing your trained workforce from a industry perspective, but it's very rewarding from a teaching perspective to watch students grow into that ownership of their research problem and confidence in themselves.
I'll ask you this next question, Dr. Zakari. So you touched earlier on having some not-so-good research students and some good research students. What makes up the not-so-good research students and what differentiates them from having a really good researcher?
Well, as Cherise said, mentoring undergraduates is a bit more difficult or challenging. But what makes it, as far as our work is concerned, as far as research is concerned, you don't have to be a brilliant and get all A to be a great researcher because you have to just love their work and you want to spend the time. You have to be curiosity. In my book, people who are curious usually do well. And a lot of the students, one of the jobs that I've had for the past 30 years, and I've seen the students coming and going, is the fact that they are, as Cherise was saying, like me, underconfident, coming from a background which is very similar to me, first person, in a way, going to school, first person Probably the only person who has gotten a PhD after all the things in their families and surrounding. And a lot of them being also women or being in a different situation, like people of color who are in a situation that everybody tells them research is a waste of time. That's one of the hardest things to deal with them. You have to not only deal with the students and what they love and how they encourage them, you have to deal with the community. That's why we have programs that both of us are involved in a sense in different way. In my program, we only encourage both teach the students and teach their family that this is an important thing for them to do. And what distinguished the students between these, to go back to your original question, is that when they're not really interested, okay, if you come into the lab, we do experiment after experiment. I am working on the same question that I asked 30 years ago, okay, in a different way. So I have contributed a lot. It doesn't mean that we don't have anything to do. In the past 30 years, I have 110 papers and 6 books. So I have done something, but I still am asking the questions. And there are days after days you go to the lab and you do experiments and nothing happens after a month or 2 months and nothing getting up. And the student who is really interested, they know it's hard work, but they are still interested in and curious to do. And that makes them a good student in my book. I help all of them, even the bad ones. Okay. And the bad ones are, I shouldn't say bad, but they're less interested in research, are the ones that have a different purpose. It's not bad to make money. I'm not saying that. We all need money in order to live. But if your focus in life is, okay, how can I just use this to go to the next step to make money? To me, in my lab, you're not going to make it because my lab has a very, very different chemistry. We are a family, and the family has this question to ask, and everybody works for that. And these are how the thing. So the good students usually very much are directed. They want to do this stuff, and they don't. They get discouraged, and we have to pull them out as a scientist. And I'm absolutely sure Charisse would agree with this, that we are not only scientists. We are teachers, we are scientists, we are psychologists, we are accountants, we are cleaners, we are everything. And that makes it, at first I realized, my God, this is so many different hats I wear. Then you really love it and you know that this is your forte. And I tell my students that not everybody has to do what we do. You don't have to be an academic. There are so many different things you can do as a researchers. And some of them who are really interested in that and they want to do that, they grab in different ways and they go on. But the ones who really don't, and I said they're not bad students, they're just not really for research, is that they don't have their hearts into it. You cannot come to a lab if you don't really want to do it. This is not a place that you're going to be a millionaire in an hour, okay? And you're going to have your Nobel Prize in 2 days. So this is a thing that you have to really work hard, like every part of our life, I think. And those students just don't, they sort of leave or they don't do their parts in the lab. And as I said, my lab kids are the best teachers because they sort of nudge you out if you're not doing your share or if you're not interested. I've had students telling the other one, why are you here? You don't really like this stuff, you know? They do tell them, and I sort of sit back and listen to them because they block each other more. They want to be a community more. And it's really, it's been an amazing journey for me to see all of that and to learn from it.
You talk a lot about the challenges that research students might face. So Dr. Evans, I'm curious to hear, what's the average day like for a researcher? You know, what's it like entering the lab and, you know, from the minute you enter to the minute you leave?
Well, first I want to say that Sara's right. I know I'm mispronouncing your name. I'm sorry.
Zara is fine.
Grades never pinpoint a good research student. The last really good research student I had as an undergraduate barely graduated Queen's College by the skin of her teeth because she couldn't take an exam. She had severe test anxiety. And she's now working on a NASA-funded project at Harvard. And I got a call from Harvard and they were like, we just have one question about this person. I'm like, I know what your question is. So what do you think our question is? I said, how can a person that has that much curiosity and be that good at asking questions not be in a graduate program? And they went, yep, that's our question. And I said, the truth is I couldn't figure out how to get her through a PhD program without ever having to take an exam. And that has really made me rethink exams as our sole assessment. And I try not to set my classes up where the exams are the sole assessment in the class, because I think we do a disservice to students who don't test well, but learn a lot. I mean, you could give her an oral exam and tell she knew the stuff and she could answer the question. The moment you put it down in writing, she couldn't answer them. Never could figure out how to get her over that. But she had what it took to be a researcher, because she had curiosity out the wazoo. I mean, she was always asking questions. And that's what identifies a good research student, is one that will keep asking questions. In terms of a typical life of a researcher, you're always asking questions. Even when you're preparing your lecture notes to teach, you're asking, do I understand this? Is there a better way that I can cover this? And in terms of going into the lab, that's what you're doing. You're always looking for, you know, well, that didn't work the way I thought it was going to work. Why didn't it work the way I thought it was going to work? Do I understand this problem? Is it not behaving the way I thought it was going to behave because we made a mistake or because that's natural? And sometimes you just have to say, well, interesting, not enough time, not an important problem. We'll work on it later. And file it away, because, you know, you have funding and you have funding for a particular project and you can't go off on every tangent. But if you're a research student, it depends on what level you're at. If you're a beginning student, undergrad or grad, you come into the lab terrified. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what's expected of me. I don't want to look like an idiot. I don't want the people around me to think I'm stupid when I ask these questions. And then as you learn and ask questions and get confidence that your mentor's not going to chew you out unless you do something really stupid, which means, i.e., endanger yourself, your colleagues, or almost hurt a really expensive, irreplaceable piece of equipment. That's really stupid. Those three things is what I count as you're going to get your butt chewed out. Anything else is you're learning and, you know, all's forgiven. But those three things we got to talk about. You begin to get confidence. And if you have that innate curiosity and you're asking questions and you're learning, you're going to begin to do what my teacher called take ownership of the problem, which means you're going to begin to go off on your own and read about what you're supposed to be doing in the lab. You're going to begin to come in with questions that we didn't pose for you, but that you are beginning to pose. Now, at the undergraduate level, the questions you're asking are going to be a little bit less sophisticated, but the process is the same for an undergrad or a grad student. And then as you begin to grow past that, at some point you become good enough that you're seeing So at the beginning, if data doesn't behave the way your mentor said it should behave, you're going to go to your mentor and say, you know, I don't know. What should I do now? As you take ownership of the problem, if the data doesn't behave the way it's supposed to, you're going to test it. You're going to figure out ways to test it before you even show it to your mentor. You're going to probe it and see, you know, is it right? Is it wrong? Are these data really showing something unique? And then once you do that, you're going to bring it to your mentor and say, I double checked this. I did these other experiments. This is the way it is. And I don't understand it. That's a person who's beginning to take ownership of the problem. Now, as a PhD student, toward the very end of that, you may even come to your mentor and say, I saw this, I did this, and here's what I think is causing it. And that's the difference between an undergrad and a PhD student at what? Advanced research student, ready to graduate, ready to write their thesis.
Dr. Evans, you lead a chemistry lab, and Dr. Zakaria, you lead a biology lab. So people are probably curious to know, what are the differences between the two? And I guess Dr. Zakaria will ask you, what's it like working in a biology lab? You know, what do you do?
Well, my lab is sort of a mixed lab in a sense. It's As I said, I came myself in a very different background, and I brought mathematical and statistical things into what I wanted to, because that's what I love, and physical things. And I'm also a professor of biochemistry, so I have that as a background. So my background is not When you say biology, different people think of something else. Like myself, when I was younger, I thought of biology as going as archaeology more than anything else. That's what I thought biologists meant. And Charisse brought NASA, and my biggest dream to go into being a biologist and then being a geneticist, I thought I'd go to space and be one of those things. I love those. I'm a junkie for all of these space. So then as I grew up, I realized that, okay, maybe I'm a little too little and I'm not in the right place to go to space, but my experiments could go to space. So I did things like that. As a biologist, so in my laboratory, we work with a very sort of holistic way of looking at this. I'm a virologist as for my PhD training. So right now, a lot of my kids were there and a lot of them are undergraduate right now, and they're going there at different time doing their work. We work on both biological questions, okay, cellular level, and I have also a molecular biology specialty. So as a molecular level, what the whole thing is all about, and then we do it in biochemical way. So what are the different chemicals that might be used in order to be, we're working on antiviral drug, how we can lower the viruses. And at the moment, my lab works on Zika, dengue, and we are toying, and I'm sort of like talking to people about the COVID, obviously, is our big thing. We work with different viruses, influenza, and all of them seems to have a common path. So we are working on those things. So in my lab, one of the things that Charisse said that sort of triggered a thing for my mind is that some of my students, as an undergraduate, they have been, you said, what makes a good student in a sense. You know that they're serious. I have had undergraduates who are first author of 3-4 papers in my lab. Okay, and they end up as going to Johns Hopkins and MIT. They go to those places for a PhD and everything, and they come from backgrounds which they themselves cannot believe they got there. So I think our role at Queen's College especially, but other places as well, is really to make sure we identify these people. I worked for many years with Dr. Wilma Safran, who was the previous director of the HMNS, and now I'm working with Charisse. I think our role is very important in a way to identify the students, put them in the right track, okay? And that is the thing. So as a biologist, I will show them what are the different things they could work on, whether it's biochemical aspect, and the students choose which ones they're really interested in. So in my lab, they have, as a biologist, they could do a so-called classical biology of way of looking at the problem, or biochemical way, or mathematical way of looking at the problem. And the students, when they get there, you give them options, okay? And then they fit themselves into different parts of it. So a typical day of a student is like what they're doing now. They come in the morning, and Dr. Zakaria always tells them, oh, you're late. Why didn't you come earlier? And they come and they do their work. And often they're there, they go to class, they come back, they have their desk, they have a home. A lab is their home. And we are a family. That's basically how my lab works, as a biology or whatever technically they're doing. And they go to their class. I mean, this was the normal prior to COVID. They go to the lab and they come back, and then we are all there and we have lab meetings. And if they have questions, my office is right in front of my lab. They walk right in there. Dr. Z, I need this, or what should we do this? If they're running out of things, they make lists. A typical lab is they do all of this work. And I give my even undergraduate ownerships. We have lab jobs, so everybody is responsible. So we have a safety officers, we have different officers, and we have rules of who does what. And they're responsible for doing everything in the lab. We don't have people who come and clean for you. You clean for yourself. So, and you, one person is in charge of making sure that we have orders to, I have assistants, so they tell her what they need to order, and on and on. So everybody is basically comes in and fits, and the new students are taught by the older students. I have mentors, so I'm this, and then we have a hierarchy of mentors. So they're not just going to come in there and start all over again. And we have daily meetings. And when I was there in the lab, I saw my kids all the time. I'm in the lab. I used to do a lot more experiments physically myself, and now I do less of it. But I'm there. I do analysis of data with them. So, and then they sit down and we have a corner and they teach each other. So it, work in the biology lab or any, I think in most of the labs, is the fact that you come in the morning and you have a question, you're answering your own experiment, but you also have all these interactions. And I think that really helps the students to have a sense of belonging and they don't get lost. So if they need to take a course, they ask each other, or they ask me, is this a good one for me to graduate? I usually make a two-year plans for them or a three-year plans whenever they come in. And then they said, these are the things you take to make sure you leave on time. I really don't like the students. If they're in the MARC program, they're even more, they don't even have to be in my lab. They're in a lot of different labs. The program actually is only for research. We're training them for research and we send them to different labs. But my own kids that are in my lab also, they get the benefit of all of these advising. And you really need that, because if you don't advise the students the right way, they stay there 7 years. They just, you lose them. So in order to keep them, you say, this is what you take, this is what you do, and you sort of walk them through. And unfortunately, they have to leave, but they leave for better things, okay? And hopefully what they do before they leave, they teach somebody else how to take over.
Happens. You and I both know that I worked in an organic chemistry lab briefly for a summer, and it involves a lot of, you know, hands-on work with, you know, lots of chemicals getting on your hands and lots of techniques that you ordinarily don't use in a biology lab. So what's your experience like in physical chemistry when you're working in the lab or when your students are?
Well, physical chemistry involves less chemicals than organic chemistry. And in fact, I got really lucky. I love math as well. But I thought chemistry was all about making chemicals. And if I had not been taking physical chemistry at the same time as organic, I would have switched majors back to mathematics because I realized I hated synthetic chemistry. I do still do synthetic chemistry on occasions because it keeps me humble. One of the issues that physicists tend to have, and physical chemists fall in that too, is this idea that we can do anything we want to. And we, you know, we can teach whatever we want to. And the truth is I can't teach organic. I don't have that inherent knowledge that you build because you've worked in the lab for 20 years and you've empirically hands-on developed this understanding of how chemicals react. I don't have that. But I do have the same type of understanding for how light interacts with molecules, how molecules dissolve into solutions, the types of interactions that need to occur for things to go into solutions, because that's the type of question a physical chemist asks. So it's just, you know, different things. And I do the same thing. I have math problems, computer science problems, some synthetic problems, but more in line of not can I make something new, but can I understand why this thing reacts the way it does? So I'm asking a different question than an organic chemist is asking. An organic chemist is trying to probe new reaction pathways. Can I make something new? Can I change the pathway? I'm asking, why does this grow the way it grows? For instance, on a small particle, why does it assemble the way it does? What causes that assembly? And if I tweak something, how does it change that assembly? So it's a different type of question. It's such a downer for me because, you know, I get excited with really fundamental problems and I'll go talk to the organic chemist I usually talk to, which is Bill Hirsch. Hey, look at this. And he's like, okay, that's interesting. What's it good for? Ah! You know, because I'm a physical chemist. I don't ever ask what's it good for. I ask, you know, can I learn something new physically about chemistry from it? But I do occasionally try to do organic synthesis, but it really is because it keeps me, it reminds me how hard that is. It reminds me to appreciate all aspects of chemistry. And it helps me also when I take a lot of students into my lab who won't stay in my lab because the organic chemists won't, they wouldn't take students after Gen Chem 1. So we had all these students that had just taken Gen Chem 1, and getting them started in research as soon as possible is really important, especially for the bright students. You know, I know that they're really going to be organic chemists. I can tell that by their interest, but they just don't have enough training yet to go into an organic lab. So for those students, I'll take them for a semester and train them in lab techniques on the few little synthetic problems I've got, and then I'll let them go and transfer them into the organic lab with the person I think they'll mesh with, because it really is a family, and it's really important that the research students mesh with the rest of the lab. Our labs are too small to take in a student that doesn't mesh. If you have one dysfunctional student, it creates dysfunction in the entire family. But what Sara was describing in her lab is some of what I'm trying to codify for HM&S, and that's this idea of a growing skill in the lab. So going from an apprentice to a journeyman to a master in a particular technique, going from a person who's basically a pair of hands in the lab to a person who's leading the research in their group and training the next person. And this is in HM&S, part of what I'm working on developing is something called a work transcript, where the mentors can write down, you know, for this any given student in their lab, where they're at in that journey and how well they work in different areas, because sooner or later we have to write letters of recommendation because we are advisors for a particular program. And that can be really hard if you don't know the student, because they're not your research student, but you're supposed to write a letter. So I'm hoping that by doing these work transcripts and bringing these in, that I can get to know the student from their work history in the lab that they were in. But also that'll help me identify problems of a student that's not perhaps meshing well with a lab, but is too shy to say and hunt for another mentor. Because every once in a while that happens, where a student just doesn't mesh well, but they're like, I don't want to offend my current mentor by going and finding another mentor or another project, because it turns out I'm just not really interested in this project. And that's okay. But, you know, once you've invested a couple of semesters, it's hard to just say that. You don't want to offend your mentor, the mentor you had, and you're scared that, you know, if I tell them I'm just not interested in their project, they may not write a letter of recommendation for me because I'll offend them. And the truth is you're an undergraduate and you're growing all the time, and you may find another area that interests you more. And I think we all understand that as researchers, that as a student progresses through their career as an undergraduate, they may find an area of their field that is more fascinating than what we're doing. I'm okay with that. My colleagues really like students that come out of my lab because they're trained. You know, when I accept students straight out of Gen Chem 1, I know that only about 10% are going to stay with me to do research. The other 90 are going to go off to other colleagues with my blessing, and usually with my recommendation. Go talk to so-and-so. I think you'll like what they're doing.
You actually just answered my next question, so I'll ask you this, Dr. Zakaria. So let's just say I am a sophomore. I just completed biology 105 and 106. For those who don't know, these are the introductory biology courses you take. And let's just say I email you and I say, hi, my name is Sid Malvia. I would like to be a part of your lab. What goes through your mind as a mentor? What are you thinking? And do you want to know about my grades? Do you want to know how motivated I am to do the project? You know, what are you looking for? Especially if I haven't even been a part of the lab before. Like, I'm just brand new and I really like your work.
Right. Most of the people are just like that, that come to our labs. So at least in my lab. So what I do immediately, I'll ask them to come and talk to me. I don't look at their numbers or anything. I interview them in person. I sit with them and I ask them questions about to try to find their motivation, okay? And also to whether they really have, first of all, is also important. You asked me about what is it to do a biology lab in a sense, and I'm not sure I completely answered it in a sense that when you come in, you need time, okay? So you have to have time to be in the lab. So if you only have 2 hours a week, that's not going to make it in my lab. So my first question is, how much time do you have? And also whether they could, my work, basically, we are looking at how a cell thinks And we are looking at how viruses manipulate all the different parts of the cells and how they could be prevented to do that. And those are only one side. Another side of my lab works on differences between male and female response to different stresses. And we work on gender differences in their response to disease, to viruses, to et cetera. But again, all of this stuff is very time consuming to do in the lab. And it's not just theoretically, you have to get your hands wet in a sense. But you also have to read. I make my students read one or two papers a week, okay? So I tell them what I expect from the students. And I tell them really to think about whether you want to come into my lab. And I tell them, have you talked to people about how it is to be in my lab? That's another thing. Do you know what I expect? And they usually said, yes, we have, or no, we haven't. If they say no, I said, go and talk. Make sure that you really would like to work with someone like me, because I'm pretty demanding. So I and in my interview, I try to assess whether they really want to do this thing and how much they are. Also assess what they know. Okay, I think talking to the students, for me personally, is the best way to judging whether they should come to my lab or not. I hardly expect, I do not sort of accept somebody to just by sending me, I'm this class, is that I got an A in all of these, I'm going to come in. No, I have had, students which are honor students, okay, they're Macaulay, I've had a lot of Macaulay students in my lab, and some of them were amazing researchers and some of them were not. As a matter of fact, one of our papers right now that is referred to, especially with COVID coming in that all the time, the first author is an undergraduate of Macaulay, okay, who is going to right now go to actually dental school or do some pharmacy things. But still, she was fantastic. And she came to me as a junior person. She actually came to me the summer before she even started the Queen's College. And she has read one of my articles and she said that she really got interested in it. And I said, and when I talked to her, there was just this amazing enthusiasm in it. It just lightened my heart. I loved it. And I said, and she was like, she looked like she's 12 years old. And I said, come to my lab. And I'm so happy that I talked to her and I gave her that benefit of 15 minutes of talking, and it really took 15 minutes. I said, okay, I test you, and I tell all of them, you have a few months for me to work with you. If we love each other, you stay. If we don't, you go to somebody else's lab and I help you, like Shirley's. I'll help you find out. I'm a director of this undergraduate thing that we have all these mentors, so we send them to somebody else. Or I call Shirley's and say, do you have a mentor for this person? So it's one or the other. So she just came and she blew me away. Her enthusiasm, she knew nothing. She didn't even know how to hold on a pipette. But she was so enthusiastic. By the end of the summer, she knew exactly what she's doing. And I put her with somebody else to just be a pair of hands or to just watch. That's what I do, because it's a lot of this stuff is also dangerous, so you just don't jump into it. You sort of work your way to these more and more, because we work with, not only bad chemical, but also bad viruses. And you have to know that. And we also work with animals, which is I have to train them very specially. But she took over all of this. So my assessment of the student is usually whether they want to do the work. And the best way I assess them is to talk to them. Now, I've had students who academically have not been so great, but they have worked, and I try my best. Some of them you could rescue their academic thing, and some of them you don't. And I'm sure you are a young person, and you know in your colleagues, a lot of the time, it's not just because the student doesn't want to study. There is a lot of, in Queen's College especially, I guess, and colleges like Queen's College, there are people from different financial backgrounds that come in. I've had students who literally was kicked out of his house. And an individual, at first I didn't know. And another one of my kids said they had not enough money to pay for the rent and they were sleeping on the park. So the first thing for us to do is to find them a place. And I have to say, our president was amazing. So I actually went to the president of Queens College and said, this kid has nowhere to sleep. We need to find a house for them. And they gave him a fellowship of staying in the dorm until he got back onto his seat. So there is not just a research problem. The reason I'm bringing those up is that doing research is amazing. And to me, it was the best thing in my life because it allowed me to do everything other than research. Okay, I want the people to understand that, the young people who want to go to, it's not just being in the lab and mixing chemicals and putting this. It's the idea of talking about, first of all, I tell my kids, you could have the most brilliant answer. If you don't know how to tell somebody else about it, the world doesn't know. So I make my students not only to read, but to present. My kids are forced to go in meetings to present their, I have begged and done everything and paid from personal thing for my kids to go to meetings and to present their work. And I force them to meet other people who are Nobel Prize winners. Said they're just like you. They have two arms, two feet, two eyes, you know, you can be them. So that's the hunt. But a lot of time is also to take some of the obstacles. And it's really amazing feeling when you can do all of that. The human part of research sometimes is totally lost. And I think it's one of the problem researchers have. The reason that we have other people coming and going out and saying that scientists don't know what they're talking about. I think you know exactly who I'm talking about right now. That they don't know. We don't have to listen to the virologists. We don't have to listen to the experts. They don't know. It's because we as a scientist have a responsibility to go out there to tell people why you should pay for our research. I mean, we don't do these things out of our own money, okay? We do it because some taxpayers, our own taxes and everybody else's, goes to these places called National Institute of Health, NIH, or other thing, NSF. Mine is mostly NIH. And they give money back to us to do the work. But aside from us having responsibility to do it ethically, which is really important, to publish about it and to tell other people, we have to tell the lay people, why is it important that we do research? And that's another thing that I think it's important for us students to come in or think about research, to think that this isn't just a very, very narrow thing. This is much bigger than you think. You have to go out there and present it. And a lot of them do. A lot of them right now, like one of my students is a chancellor. I mean, I look at him and say, my kid is a chancellor of this university. And he is going out there telling everybody else. And when he invited me, this guy, and he was holding me and said, this is my mentor. I felt like, my God, I thought I was working on air. But he is telling everybody else how to do. And when I listened to him talk in a presentation he did to his class, it was just, I just couldn't sustain myself. He was saying what I told him when 20 years ago, when he just walked into my lab, and he was telling everybody, this is our responsibility. He was telling the students that. So I think it's much bigger than us doing this. And a long time ago, I remember somebody asked me, why do I had to make a decision. Okay, I had to make a decision. Do I just stay in my lab and write another science paper or nature paper or this? Or do I take my time and go out and talk about this work others? And that's a really, really big decision to make. Because whenever you do something else on top of your research, you are taking away a little bit from your research. And I think Charisse and everybody else know that. Okay, so they asked me, why do you do that? And when I was standing there, I got this award that they gave me. And they said, why you go all over these third world countries and try to establish science and encourage students to do this? I said, because I looked at myself and I said, a paper is for me. And of course, my students, but if I do this, I can tell a lot of people. And I think that's also comes with the research and our responsibility. So whether I'm a biologist or astrophysicist or chemist or mathematician, we have that responsibility as well to do that. So I don't know if I diverted too much from your original thing or I answered it, but my assessment of the student is to sit down and talk to them and to tell them this is what you have to do. So it's not that you're going to just mix up, and I will help you to understand this is what you have to do, but are you willing to listen? And if they're willing to listen, they come to my lab.
You've made such a profound impact on so many students' lives. Dr. Evans, do you have a, you know, memorable student that you remember that, you know, their life just transformed completely after working in your lab?
I have one graduate student that I remember who's currently at Cornell. In his case, he had an unusual path to graduate school. I mean, when as a graduate student, he was normal. But if you'd looked at his transcript, he never graduated high school. So he got a GED, went to community college in California, did well, transferred from community college to four-year college in California, did well in chemistry, and then went into the PhD program. So I remember his because that reminds you that there are many paths to get a degree. And the last two students, one who is now at UCLA in physics, and the one that is at Harvard working as a technician. The first one was a brilliant student, and you knew he was going to succeed. He did the BA MA program in chemistry and physics in 5 years and got graduated, therefore, with 4 degrees. So you know that type of student's going to go and succeed. What makes that interesting was that student was loved research at Queens College, was a wonderful research student. And published some papers. But when he went on to the physics PhD program, and I talked to him after his year and a half, he was like, I don't think I'm cut out for this. And I told him, I was like, look, physics, the first 2 years in the PhD program is really course heavy. And I said, I think when you get back in the research lab, you'll find the joy in the work again. Said, so just stick with it, and I think it'll come back. And it has, and he has stuck with it, and he's now doing research, and he's got about to get his first paper out. But what that told me was we really ought to, all programs have kind of a historical, this is how we do it, you know. But I think perhaps sometimes we need to reevaluate and think about how we're doing and what we're doing. Because what I thought at the time was if you can kill the interest in research and in a subject matter that that student had because of how you've got your PhD program formulated, then something's wrong. And UCLA's program is no different than any other physics program across the nation. But it makes you think, well, maybe, you know, there needs to be a change in how physics is taught at the PhD level. Now, I can work with physics programs, but I'm not inherently a physicist, and the physicists would probably throw a fit if they heard me say that, because I'm a chemist, and I approach this from a chemist's perspective. But, and the student that made me reassess the importance of examinations, because these students taught me something not just about research, but they made me rethink what is our job as a faculty member. What does it mean to learn something? What does it mean to teach something? What does it mean if we get so caught up in this is how it has to be because this is how we were taught that we perhaps lose the idea of were we really taught that way or when did we really learn what we learned?
Back at your lengthy careers and looking ahead towards the uncertainty of the future, what's one thing that you reflect on from, you know, being a mentor, being an undergraduate student, being a postdoc, PhD, all the, you know, research experiences in your life? What's one thing you want listeners to know, particularly those who want to get into research? And I guess we'll start with you, Dr. Zakari.
I think I might have said a little bit about it. The researchers that I said that it's over the years, I learned slowly. You know, I didn't know, as I said, like what Sari said, I was not even confident enough that I could do. I'm an immigrant. Okay, I come from my parents. We came here when I was 16 years old, and I come from a background. Although my father believed in education a lot, I come from a background that women not necessarily have to go to college or not do that. And I saw many women around me not doing it, but including for my own mother, who was pulled out of school at third grade because the father thought that the girls shouldn't go to school. but she always thought that I should be independent. So that was really good. And she was a very strong woman in that sense. So I have had that type of thing. And I think what we have to remember over the years is how to build confidence in the students that come in. As I said, they all come in with a package, in a sense. Okay, and there's different. I've had students who walked into my lab with when I started, actually one of my first PhD students, I've had 14 of them, and he had a child already, a second one on the way, worked two jobs, and came to me and said, I really love what you do, and I want to do this stuff, and I don't have enough time, or can I still do a PhD? And I said, absolutely. So as we were saying before, I adapted his work on his thesis to him. And he did amazing biochemistry work in my lab, things that I wasn't even doing. And we know we really learned a lot together because I didn't know how things would work out either. And we have written papers in Frontier. And then he went and he worked for Department of Defense, and he's a big head of a lab somewhere, and now he is doing other things. So to be able to understand how people come in with their different backgrounds, I think has had a great impact. To be able to sort of rethink what research is all about for me, because you grow into it yourself. And I think the best thing, if I had to tell anybody, is not to be so static. Okay, to be fluid, so you could learn and change with the time. Like right now, we had to totally rethink our entire life, our entire teaching, our entire research. And we are probably not doing it all the way right. I know, I'm sure I'm making mistakes and learning, but it's a learning curve. And if you don't say, okay, this is exactly what we have to do, and be relaxed about it, okay, let me conform like a liquid to whatever you put me in. Not that we don't want to put any rules in it, but to learn from it. How does it work? And not to be so rigid in your thinking. That's exactly. And the future, and another thing is, it's a really tough time, I think, for young people to go into research. It has been a tough time for years. One of my most difficult things to do right now, or has been for the past years, and that's one of the things that every year that we get together, and I have been on NIH Council, and I've been on NIH panel reviews, and every time we talk about this constantly. How do you get students, how do you get young people to be motivated to go to research? Because there are so many negatives as well that people, they think about. As I said, the work in the lab itself is long hours. You have to give up a lot of things for it, a lot of parties, a lot of doing family things, a lot of, you know, your kids' things. You have to give up in order to be able to do your research. And it would become, so that's, you can think of it as negative, or you can think of it as a step towards what you want to do, you know. But one of the hardest things has to be motivated young people. And I think it still is difficult, and we're learning how to do that and what they want there. We are working against obstacles that are there to tell you, for example, Sid, you should be a biochemist and you should be an organic chemist. In my case, opposite, and I guess that's why we have different fields, I loved organic chemistry. It was the only chemistry that made sense to me. I love the fact that it went through the steps and I could synthesize and make it. But I can understand very well, because my kids come in and say, oh, Dr. Z, we have organic, it's killing us. I don't know. I said, I don't understand. What? You don't understand. I cannot understand inorganic chemistry because it makes no sense to me. So I think the brains are differently, and you have to work with this. But it is the most difficult thing, as I've gone through all of these, has been to really justify or to tell people why they should be a scientist. And I think they should be a scientist because the world needs it. Look at our situation right now. We need everybody. We need all the people that you can imagine. But if you want to make that decision, when you think you have the capability of being a scientist, think about the fact that we have so few of us thinking that way. And to be a good scientist takes discipline, takes joy in doing what you're doing, and takes just wanting to do it. And we need it for future. Look at what's happening to our world every day. And if we more and more people get out of thinking and trying to explore new avenues, how would we find a new vaccine? You know, they call that pharmaceutical. Well, who the heck works in these pharmaceuticals? These are all our kids who are there. These are people like us who are there. The reason I didn't go to Merck, which I had my first job offer, I wasn't even a PhD student. As a master's student, was to go to Merck. And I didn't want to go there because I wanted to know why things happen. I figured if I go there, I have to stop. That would be it. I would be stuck in that kind of position. Somebody very, very smart told me that, a mentor of mine, that if you go there, the money was fantastic. Are you kidding? At that age, if I had made $60,000 a year, it was amazing. They liked what I had done. They liked it. I was still in my PhD. I wasn't even finished. But they told me if you should come now because they want to pay you and put you in a certain category. The higher you go, the more they have to invest. But all of the people who you see now coming up with the treatments, with the vaccine, with antiviral, they're all scientists, right? And this is what we need right now, and we will need even more. So I think that we should encourage our young people, and we should really get them when they are young. I mean, in schools, like when they're in first grade, second grade, introduce kids to science and introduce them in a nice, gentle way, and be able to change with the times.
And Dr. Evans, let me ask you, you know, looking back at your lengthy career and, you know, as we move ahead to the future, what's your message to listeners who maybe want to be a part of research, maybe want to work with physical chemistry?
Much the same. You just need to be interested. I mean, one of the big shocks that I've had recently was I started tutoring just a little bit high school students for Suffolk County. And what shocked me was the fact that unless a student's in AP science, none of them are given a textbook. So if you have a student that's coming in and they didn't take a single AP course, they've never even seen a textbook. And yet we expect them to come into college and, you know, go read your textbook before lecture. You know, go prepare your own worksheets to study. But they've never had to do that. Go take notes. They've never had to do that either because their notes are taken on worksheets that their teacher provides. So they've never had to actually listen to a lecture. This will really make you rethink, oh crap, we need to do something. No wonder why the fail rate in all of the introductory science courses is 50%. Our students are coming in, they don't have an idea how to study, how to write notes, how to read the textbook, because they've never had a textbook. They've never had to do any of this. And that's true across the country, but what's different at Queens College versus, say, Cornell or Columbia is we don't have the resources that they're putting into teaching students how to take notes, how to study, how to prepare for an exam. If you go look at their websites, they have all of that. And they've got webinars and lectures and boot camps and stuff that we just don't have. And I think the best way to counteract that is to start trying to reach out to students in high school, students in junior high, maybe even students in elementary school. Get rid of the graphing calculators, get rid of the worksheets, and get them involved maybe in summer boot camps or something that shows them and prepares them for college in a way that our schools are currently not doing. And no, I do not blame the teachers for that. They're caught in a system where their pay and their job is related to exams, and the only way to get students ready for exams is to give them these worksheets. So no, I don't blame the teachers for this. This is a society problem.
Wholeheartedly agree. And I will say the note about graphing calculators is a good one, because I worked firstly in Dr. Ma's lab. And for those who don't know, Dr. Ma is a biologist at the Queen's College campus. And one of his hard rules is no calculators in the lab. Do math the intuitive way and just figure it out. And I will say that has helped me long term tremendously, tremendously. But that concludes our interview. So thank you so much, Dr. Evans and Dr. Zakari, for your time.
You've been listening to the QC Pod, a podcast about all things Queen's College. The QC Pod is a production of the Queen's Podcast Lab. For more, visit queenspodcastlab.org/QCPod. Our show music is Lake Monsters by They May Be Giant. The episode was produced by Eden Ayala. Our head producer is Lizeth Moreno. Our show heads are Jason Tagaw and Joseph Cohen. On behalf of Sid Malvia, I'm Eden Ayala. Thanks for listening.